I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight we're looking at Tombstone by Yang Zhisheng, which is a personal account of the Great Leap Forward and the famine in China that came with it. The book itself is an interesting combination of personal memoir and historical memory, and the kind of the re-examination of the past, and the re-examination of personal and collective past. So tonight, I'm going to look at the question of communal kitchens. These were the kitchens that were established in towns and villages across China in place of cooking and communal space in the home. Essentially, in a village which would have been part of a collective, and a collective would have been part of a commune, the food distribution and the feeding of the people had been collectivised, and so there was now no individual food preparation or cooking in any home. This was a means of controlling food allocation, controlling rations in essence, and therefore inducing further levels of excessive work. But it was also, as we shall see, the part of Mao's assault on the concept of the family. The kitchens lasted between 1958 and 1961, the peak years of the famine, which killed, some historians argue, 40 million. Some believe anything up to 70 million. Obviously, Frank Dakota's book, Mao's Great Famine, in the last part of the book, there is the breakdown of the statistical analysis on how many died. Anyway, Yang Zhisheng writes, "The communal kitchens, although a component of the people's communes, deserve separate attention because of their direct relevance to the Great Famine. Communal kitchens opened in the summer and autumn of 1958 and closed in the summer of 1961, but their disastrous consequences far surpassed that brief time frame. Seeing the family as the social foundation of the private ownership system and a major impediment to communism, some reformers advocated eliminating the family, a notion that appealed to Mao and other leaders of China's Communist Party in their youth. In a speech on March the 22nd, 1958, Mao said, "In socialism, private property still exists, factions still exist, families still exist. Families are the product of the last stage of primitive communism, and every trace of them will be eliminated in the future. Kang Youwei perceived this in his Great Harmony. Historically, the family has been a production unit, a consumption unit, and a unit for giving birth to the next generation of the labour force and educating children. Now worker families are no longer production units. This is even more the case for families involved in the bureaucracy and the army. It is possible that in the future, the family will no longer be beneficial to the development of productivity. Many of our comrades don't dare to consider problems of this nature because their thinking is too narrow. When Ian Kershaw formulated his theories about how decision-making took place in Nazi Germany and looked at cumulative radicalisation, this idea that Hitler spoke in broad visions but never wrote things down and never really went into specifics with henchmen because he didn't want to be kind of pinned down on what he was really getting at. He called it the model of working towards the Führer. And there is perhaps an equivalent version in China of, you know, working towards the great helmsman, if you like, of Mao articulating certain views and then local and regional functionaries interpreting those views and doing the kinds of things they imagine Mao wants them to do. Followers took action once Mao had given out these thoughts, and they began to organise canteens and these had been organised before for busy farming seasons. However, when the upper leadership saw these makeshift canteens as really being the kind of the ultimate expression of communism within the peasant village, they became enormously significant. The party activists and party cadres would rip out cooking utensils, ovens, stoves, and anything else of use from homes, and often these things would be either left to moulder in a barn, or they would be, if they were, you know, worth stealing, would be recycled, you know, handed on to beneficiaries somewhere, and the food cooking equipment would be established in a communal building in the village, and that's where food would be prepared. Mao seemed to think that severing the link between food and payment was a great innovation. He looked to the biography of the Han warlord Zhang Lu, who wrote of his army dining for free, basically, at roadhouses without having to pay. And he saw this as a great example. During two visits to Henan province's bumper wheat harvest exhibitions, these were the Chinese version of the Potemkin village, of showing Mao and the other members of the party leadership how successful certain provinces had been. It was almost always untrue. One of the reasons why the famine spirals out of control and Mao is so indifferent towards it is that Mao genuinely believes in some cases that that there are bumper harvests happening all over the place because he's being told the information that he wants to hear. But anyway, during the visit to Henan Province's bumper wheat harvest on July the 19th and August the 6th, 1958, Zhou Enlai commended the communal kitchens. When he heard that Henan's communal canteens didn't charge for their meals, he said, "Shanghai's communal canteens only sell meals. They're not as good as those here." He said, "Thorough liberation required liberating women from their household duties, and he promoted communal kitchens and communal nurseries as sprouts of communism." Some of Liu Shaoqi's encouraging words for communal mess halls are quite revealing. Speaking to the leading party group of the All China Women Federation on June 14th, 1958, he noted, "Chairman Mao speaks of three no's: no government, no country, no family. This will be implemented everywhere in future. Chairman Mao has said twice that the family must be eliminated. I wonder how well you understand this concept. You need to sit down and talk about it. Of course, the elimination of the family won't happen tomorrow, but sometime in the future. In China, Kang Youai was the first to talk of eliminating the family. He advocated men and women marrying no more for no more than a year, and said that this would eliminate families in 60 years. He was thinking in terms of eliminating private property. He believed that families held private property, and that by eliminating families, it would be possible to eliminate private property. He said as if a wife and children were considered to be one's own personal property, it would be impossible to achieve the common good for all. For that reason, he advocated eliminating the family. Chairman Mao says the family is a historically produced phenomenon and will be eliminated. Now, this notion of the family being a historically produced phenomenon, I mean, well, yes, of course, it kind of is. However, the elimination that he speaks of was in the service of this kind of Maoist notion of a surge into the future, when the entire population can be mobilised en masse as one, then China, particularly a Maoist vision of China, would overtake the rest of the world. There was, of course, before Mao's revolution, or Mao's seizure of power, more to the point, the idea, kind of a chattel view of marriage in much of rural China, that women and children were the properties of their husbands. And some of the more progressive voices within the Chinese Communist Party, of course, wanted to dismantle this and to end the idea of a kind of chattel slavery, and obviously the kind of the various hideous practices like foot binding and that kind of thing. But that's not what Mao is really talking about in this instance. Mao is basically wanting to break up family units, which are obstacles to, firstly, the power of the state. The whole idea is that there is no barrier, no institution, no structure that exists between the state and the individual, or Mao and the individual. And secondly, this was a means of mobilising the entire workforce, of giving the most vital commodities and resources, food and food distribution and food preparation, over to the state. And it was a way of also tearing apart private space, private spheres, much as the Soviet Union had an antipathy towards the private sphere of family life, and thus the practice of cramming families into flats together, which had perhaps been suitable for one family and wound up being a home for four or five, to make sure there was no privacy, everyone could hear everybody else. The paper-thin walls or curtain partitions meant that families never had secrets. And also it was an inducement in the Soviet Union to kind of shove people out to kind of enjoy communal and public spaces, because in the private sphere, conspiracies could be talked of, and dissent could occur, and regimes born of revolutions have a particular kind of paranoid thinking. In his speech, as if to emphasise the point, Liu Shaoqi continued, "At present, there is a great deal of wasted manpower in society. Household duties are performed by each family. Each family makes meals. Every family washes clothes. Every family raises children. Every family mends clothes and makes shoes. Embarking on communist society should liberate women from all household labour. For that reason, this is my vision. We need to establish many nurseries and communal kitchens and run many service-type industries. Henan has an agricultural cooperative with more than 500 households, among which more than 200 households run a communal kitchen and no longer cook meals at home. After the communal kitchen was organised, the workforce increased by 30%. Previously, 200 people were cooking meals. Now only 40 people cook. And people are eating more and better.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalised plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
While saving grain. The biggest advantage is the reduction from 200 people cooking to 40 people cooking. Making cooking a collective undertaking has brought greater productivity and economy. But you see, this was not the case. There was constant propaganda that families that ate at communal kitchens ate better and ate more. And the government announced the quantities of rice that could be consumed and the amount of food, meat, and vegetables, and other things that you would almost like to receive in a communal kitchen, but this was never the case. And also, it meant sure that work norms could be imposed and working quotas could be imposed on communes, particularly work away from the land, work that the peasants were unsuited to. And experienced him, and it meant that those who were not meeting their work quotas were subject to penalties, particularly food penalties. Yang Zhisheng writes, in setting up the mess halls, homes were dismantled, and woks, basins, bowls, cups, and other cooking utensils, plus chairs and tables, were requisitioned. Grain supplies were centralised at the communal kitchen, along with firewood, livestock and poultry. Even wild herbs were handed over to the canteen. In some villages, cadres allowed commune members to retain a few pots and pans to reheat food brought home from the mess hall. Kindergartens, nurseries and facilities for the elderly were established with resources seized from families without compensation, and homes were vacated to house the facilities. In Mao's home village, upwards of 30% of the residential area was affected by the chaotic organisation of communal dining and living quarters. Original owners could not return to their homes, and people who had lived in their own homes were unable to preserve their property rights, leaving every family in a state of uncertainty. Of course, in some localities, widely dispersed residences were demolished, and communist new villages were built in centralised locations. If a home was torn down before the new village was built, families had to be split up with males and females quartered separately. There was at the very early days of the Russian Revolution, or the kind of the post-revolutionary society that Lenin and Trotsky and Sverdlov and Stalin began to create, something sort of similar in that a highly regimented, highly controlled workforce, there was some kind of vague attempt to split men and women up into kind of barrack living, that there was ultimately no need for family life. Children could be put into creches, and that men and women could be devoted to that thing that the Bolsheviks and Mao were obsessed with, work. It's this kind of leitmotif, this is a motif that kind of runs through revolutionary socialist thinking in the 20th century, is this absolute obsession with work, and from the kind of the forcing of class enemies to engage in manual work as humiliation, to the in both China and the Soviet Union, to the kind of raising of work to be a public virtue with the Stakhanovites in Russia, the idea that if one breaks one's work production norms, one is a public hero. And it comes down to this idea in Marx's theory that socialism is a period of struggle. This is a period of hard work. It's a period where the people are responsible for the building up of socialism, the building up of society into something where it can make that leap towards communism. Yang Jisheng writes, when Liu Shaoqi visited his home county in 1961, officials told him that Ningxiang County had a population of 840,000, but its original 700,000 dwellings had been reduced to 450,000. Of those, more than 30,000 had been occupied by the state and the collective without compensating owners, leaving only 420,000 dwellings for commune members. Buildings were also demolished to use the old brick for a great fertilizer collection campaign. Of course, these would have been mud bricks which had manure in them, which would have been very very good for putting on the fields, but not so helpful if your house has been bulldozed. Cadres and militia ransacked homes and sometimes beat and detained occupants. When villagers handed over their assets, it was in an atmosphere of extreme political pressure. The campaign against private property rendered many families destitute and homeless. Mess hall facilities had been constructed in the April and May of 1959 in Wanlei and Wanyan in Sichuan province. More than 1,000 yuan was spent on the Wanyan communal kitchen for paint, whitewash, plaster, doors and windows, at a time when pay for one day's labour was about 0.2 yuan. Around the same amount of money was spent on the Wanlei mess hall, which could seat 700 to 800 people. The dining hall of the Wanyan communal kitchen seated around 500 to 600. Apart from their red and green painted main dining halls, both canteens had several side rooms with colourful signs designated them as a club room, a library, a storeroom, male visitors, female visitors, tailor, barber, clinic, nursery and so on. The gaily decorated walls were festooned with bulletin boards for ideological writings. Walking into the canteen parlour, one was greeted by a long table covered with colourful tapestry and flower vases, thermos flasks full of hot water and reading materials. In the entryway was a flower bed with calla lilies, garden balsam and orchids. A dozen flagpoles protruded above the main entrance, with China's national flag hanging from the central and highest position. So each household would have contributed 4 or 5 yuan to the cost of the canteens. So quite a lot of money, and at least perhaps getting on for kind of a month's worth of wages. The premises had been obtained through persuasion, with dozens of households required to leave their homes, houses being kind of knocked together in a way. The 100 tables and 400 odd benches in each dining hall had been similarly commandeered. All items were painted a uniform colour to prevent recognition by the erstwhile owners. Once completed, the facilities received an endless stream of visitors and raised a buzz of excitement. Dining hall service and kitchen staff all wore white uniforms and aprons decorated with a lotus leaf motif. Visitors helped themselves to white rice, steamed rolls, steamed buns and meat and vegetable dishes, while ordinary commune members ate watery gruel. So again, the analogy of the Potemkin village was there. And it was a way, I suppose, of, if you imagine, the Marxist critique of capitalism is that capitalism extracts surplus labour value in terms of profit from workers and is a means of kind of siphoning wealth upwards. Well, this, you know, Maoism seems to kind of extract kind of surplus calorie value. The food that is denied to the peasants, whose belongings would be requisitioned to make the communal kitchens, is concentrated and given to dignitaries, guests, and that old Western visitor that might be sympathetic to Maoist China and be shown around it, the country in all its glory. In theory, households were allocated private plots, still known as ziludi, but they were not to exceed 5% of the village's average per capita land allocation, which is significantly less than the peasants would have enjoyed previously. A central committee resolution promulgated on the 29th of August 1958 stipulated that plots of land for personal use may become collectively run in the process of merging the commune. So it was easy for land for personal use to be taken away again. So if a family didn't cook at home, and it was unnecessary for the family to grow one's own vegetables because personal land for personal use could be taken away, private plots could be taken away, and with no livestock of one's own, it was therefore unnecessary to produce things like animal feed. The Central Committee recommended that land allocated for personal use of commune members must be transferred to the communal kitchen. Sichuan was the first to do this, as the provincial party secretary, Liu Jingchan, subsequently observed, "It's a good thing we insisted on taking back the land allocated for private use in Luzhou Prefecture last year. Otherwise, we'd have had to fight hard to set up communal kitchens this year. With the confiscation of livestock, poultry, household pots, only collective production was left." So it was a way of gradually eliminating any other system of creating or supplying food to oneself, other than reliance on the communal kitchens. What tends to happen in periods of famine, and you see this during the last three decades of the 19th century in India, is when the traditional structures that have evolved over many, many centuries that people rely on to deal with uncertainty, to deal with the vagaries of the climate and all these kinds of things. When these communal structures, how people rely on one another, how people share, how people hoard, how people do what they do, when you rip these away, then you leave large numbers of people defenseless against any sort of downturn in the food economy, or any change in the weather, in the environment. And if you consider all the other things in terms of forced work, in terms of essentially interfering with the way that crops were planted, removing peasants from the land and making them work on construction projects, and a whole range of other stuff, the number of kind of social and economic shocks that Mao, in the space of a year or two, delivers to peasant society, then it becomes easy to see why the death toll during the famine is so immense. Anyway, I'm going to pause there. Do pop by the new Explaining History website, www.explaininghistory.org. That's going to, over the next few months, be gradually populated with more and more content, and I'm hoping eventually to put some teaching materials on there as well, because I know that'll be helpful to everybody. Come and check us out at the Facebook group as well, and say hi. Anybody who is willing to or able to spare a little bit for the Explaining History Patreon, we do rely on a little bit of ad revenue here and the kindness of our patrons. Thanks very much, everybody. Take good care. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.